Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. How are you? It is Monday. It is the 26th of September. I hope everybody's doing all right. Hope you had a great weekend. We were out in Washington. How you doing, Riley?
I'm doing all right. It's the day before your big day.
Oh, yeah. My birthday's tomorrow. I will be, my father asked me how old I was going to be. That's always reassuring. Yesterday, I saw my dad's like, how old are you going to be? And then I had to go, I don't know. Let me, 42. I'm going to be 42. Honestly, as much as I love my dad with reluctance, I believe that. That on some level, this is still a competition to him, and he thinks he's going to win. So, is that the wrong way to look at it? Oh, it was very nice. I spent the day with my dad out in Queens yesterday.
Really?
My dad and my stepmom, Rosie, we went and had some Egyptian seafood and pigged out and on some Middle Eastern pastries. It was great.
Oh, goodness.
Yes, it was all very nice. But let's talk about Washington, because that is the important thing. The important thing is, not since August of 1968, folks, that is the high point of the opposition to the war in Vietnam, has there been a majority of people in America who believe that an ongoing conflict is wrong. And that is what is happening in this country today. It's an amazing thing. It's a beautiful thing that Karl Rove could trivialize the anti-war movement as being non-existent, yet public approval rating of Bush's overall handling of the situation in Iraq is at 32% approval. That's 67% of the people disapprove, and you could certainly see that in Washington. Now, we were down there on Friday and Saturday. I have to cop to something. On Friday, after we did our broadcast, I took a walk along the mall, because as I said on Friday, that I still have a certain amount of emotional connection somehow or another. When I walk around Washington, I look at those buildings, I look at the Capitol, I look at the White House, I look at the Washington Monument, the Lincoln Memorial, and I am uplifted somehow. I want to believe in it. I want to believe that our government is there for us. And right there on the mall, this was Friday, the day before the protest, I went to Camp Casey, which Cindy Sheehan had set up there with the crosses, with the shoes of the soldiers, with the pictures, and with the encampment, where people were just hanging out, sharing stories, talking, getting information about the protests and the rallies. And I got to be honest with you, Riley, I hung out there for like an hour and a half. I didn't really talk to anybody except some wacky poet dude who might be in town this week. I want to get him in the studio. I believe his name was Rich. Hilarious guy. He just pulled me aside and said, I got some poems for you. I'm a veteran myself. And he laid some poems on me that were great, but I tell you, I got pretty affected and pretty moved by being at Camp Casey and seeing a lot of vets come through and talking to each other and sharing stories. And then I got to be honest with you, on Saturday, I did my event, and I did freak out. I had to follow Dennis Kucinich, and it was just as bad as I thought it would be. I went to the event, the Green Festival event, which is really just a trade show of environmentally friendly products and candles and lotions and T-shirts and whatnot. But Kucinich goes on in the main room. He opens the show. Out of nowhere, about 300, 400 people show up. Out of nowhere. And literally, I'm waiting to go on stage. I'm out by the Air America booth. And I'm hearing like, he's running a political rally, and all I'm picturing is, and now the comedy of Mark Maron. And I'm like, no, I don't want to do that. So I'm freaking out. I'm making a real fool out of myself in front of our publicist and somebody, because I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm not going to bring it. How am I going to follow that?
Well, but you did, didn't you?
Well, fortunately or unfortunately, Riley, about 275 of those 300 people left. So I'm in a room full of that seats about 1,500 with about 30 or 40 people in there.
Oh,
and so I can't win. You know, it's like I'm complaining about that. I'm complaining about. But, you know, it went fine. We had some real fans there. Some of the people that came to the broadcast. But what I'm going to cop to is that I saw people loading into the mall for the protest. I did not march myself. And I regret that right now. But I want to hear from people throughout the morning, if we could, at 866-303-2270. We'd like to sort of roll calls through from people who actually, you know, were at the protest and actually have maybe little stories to tell about what they experienced there, Riley.
Well, you know, the best thing that happened this weekend for me was to watch my daughter transform herself into an anti-war activist, essentially. We were on an elevator in, not the hotel we stayed in D.C., but another hotel we were staying in. And my daughter ran into some teenage kids who apparently had been at the protest. And they gave her this No War sticker to put on her bag. And she was as proud as she could be. She was overwhelmed by having met Cindy Sheehan at our broadcast on Friday. And, you know, I saw the bus. I don't know if that was Cam Casey, but there was the bus was sitting very close to the Washington Monument.
It was right was there, driving. Right? The bus was parked, and then there was a tent there in the crossing.
Yeah, okay. That was Cam Casey.
Sure.
I went by it. Unfortunately, I didn't stop. Saturday, I couldn't make the war rally. We had a wedding to attend just outside of D.C. But it is fascinating to me that the protesters hit their mark in terms of, you know, usually if there's a protest in New York, the cops say there are 25 people there, the organizers say there's 25,000 people there. Well, in this instance, you know, they were hoping for 100,000, and the chief of police in D.C. said, yeah, they got 100,000.
Well, let's talk about those numbers in just a second, because, you know, there was a counter-movement, counter-war protest, right, and then you have the numbers of the real protest, and what, you know, what you'll see is that you'll see that some of these polls are really coming to, are really sort of manifesting themselves in the public, and that, you know, what we're really seeing in this country is a shift, a complete shift in how, you know, many of the people that once supported this president are seeing the war now. And many of the people that marched were Republicans, might be Republican again, but do not agree with this administration on this particular war policy. I want to explore those numbers a little bit in just a second. But before we go to do that, I think we should look at what happened in Iraq over the weekend and in the last week, because there is a reason why these protests exist. There is a reason why Karl Rove is wrong in saying that there is no anti-war movement. At least 1,914 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War. There were five over the weekend that went down in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan, five American soldiers. A suicide bomber swerved his sedan across a highway medium and detonated it alongside a police convoy in southeast Baghdad today. And that killed 25 people. There was a bomb was loaded onto a bicycle that went into a crowd and injured 20 people, killed one civilian. This is day to day in Iraq. And you know, you read the experiences of American soldiers there. You know, I read a piece by an American soldier who was working at a checkpoint, and what weighs heavy on his conscience is how many civilians he might have killed, and how much of that wasn't necessary. And a lot of this sentiment is fuel for the anti-war movement. When we come back, we're going to talk about, you know, just how many numbers were there, what it means for America, how many people were there in terms of anti-war protesters, and just that, you know, the beautiful shift we're seeing, and we're seeing a real humanity here. That was what was interesting too about the people I saw showing up for the protest, was just the range of people, the different types of people, from all different social classes, ethnic backgrounds. It's a monumental event, and we want to take your calls to share some experiences. Dan Pashman was down at the march, and he's got some experiences to come in and share. So we're going to get into all that in just a few minutes. Good morning. I hope you had an okay weekend. It's 14 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Join the Morning Sedition right now. Call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
We're back. It's 19 past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. It's Monday. Hope you're doing all right. Let me just plant this seed in your head, people. Morning Sedition is heading to New Jersey. We'll be broadcasting live from Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey, a week from this Friday, next Friday, October 7th. We'll keep you tuned in for details. As we were speaking about before the break, Riley and I, we were talking about just, you know, what is going on in Iraq. I mean, you look at a day-to-day sort of event list and what goes on. on in Iraq. There's suicide bombings every day. There are shootings every day. There are kidnappings every day. There are Americans being killed frequently. Five were killed in Afghanistan in a helicopter crash. And you wonder why, you know, that America, no one's wondering who listens to this show, but the bottom line is that it couldn't be more clear that this is the wrong war. This is not a war we should be involved in. And even in terms of the numbers, when you look at what happened down there on Saturday, you get numbers, as Riley said, that, you know, they expected 100,000 for the anti-war protests. And a cop, the police chief there in D.C. said, quote, "I think they probably hit that," end quote. And they usually lowball it. So if he's saying there was 100,000, and here's what you get. You get reports from the left now, from our team, are saying there's about 300,000 there. So they always highball it. So let's put it at about 200,000.
Yeah, let's split the difference. Why not?
Split the difference. Now, on the other side of it, the anti-war protesters, the pro-war rally that was expecting 20,000 people, I saw a number that there was 150 pro-war people in front of the FBI building. Then there was 400 at a rally somewhere on the mall, in a corner of the mall. So let's split the difference there. So let's say that they got about 200 out of the 20,000 they were expecting, and we got about 200,000 out of the 100,000 we were expecting. So where's the country stand?
Well, that's a very interesting question. If you look at the coverage of both rallies, you think it was even Steven, because a lot of the pro-war activity that took place over the weekend certainly got a good deal of coverage. And, of course, a lot of the anger that you see at the pro-war rallies are aimed directly at our good friend Cindy Sheehan, who really reignited the anti-war protest sentiment in this country.
You see how they do that? You see what they do, Riley? They can't take on the ideas and the principles and the real sort of philosophy, the philosophy behind the anti-war movement. They've got to attack Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan, a mother who lost her kid, who has really galvanized this protest. The pro-war ralliers attack her, as opposed to just wake up and see the veterans from three or four different wars walking by you. See the people of all ages walking by you. See Americans, see true patriots responding to reality as opposed to living in a world of hallucination. When I read some of the quotes from some of these pro-war ralliers, it's clear to see that many of them are just hypnotized. They are victims of hypnosis, of neocon death cult hypnosis, because some of the quotes coming from some of these pro-war ralliers don't even make sense. Like one woman said, "No matter what your ideals are, our sons and daughters are fighting for our freedom." Huh? Is that what they're fighting for over there? Every indication that I have seen has nothing to do with our freedom. Another woman said, "Our troops are over there fighting for our rights, and if Cindy Sheehan was in one of those countries, she would not be able to do that." So what does that mean? Does that mean that you want her to shut up because this country should be like those other countries? Or what are they even saying? These are talking points that are not founded in reality, not unlike our president.
What's scaring a lot of people that are in favor of the war, and this includes, by the way, the neocon death cult right up to the president, is that there are now, and this was very much brought out during the rally on Saturday, there are diverse voices speaking to ending this war. You've got Republicans who marched with Democrats, who marched with the hippies, who marched with the anti-war grannies, who said, "Yeah, I voted for Bush in 2000. Yeah, I voted for Bush in 2004. But you know what? This war is wrong, and I'm going to march against it."
March against it. That doesn't indicate that they might vote Democrat, but it does indicate that they are reasonable, objective Americans who are awake and are now sort of the fog is lifting over this weird sort of mist that has come over a lot of people because of the repetition of talking points and the fear and the misrepresentation of reality of what's going on there on the ground. And now it is undeniable, and this country is turning around. We're getting calls from people who are at the march. That's great. We got Rich Two Bagels. How are you, Rich? You there?
Hi.
How you doing, buddy?
All right.
How was the march?
That was fabulous, man. When we left at 4:30 to go back to our buses in Silver Spring to come back to Jersey, they were still coming, man.
Oh, yeah?
Still coming around.
So what was your count, Rich?
I said it was at least a quarter of a million, if not more.
Oh, all right. That's 250,000. And did you find yourself moved, uplifted? What was the most striking part of the experience for you?
Well, Mark, there was two. I had one comic encounter and one really inspiring encounter. The comic encounter was with those goofball counter protesters in front of the FBI building, right?
Yeah.
I'm going by. I had my chicken hawk in chief world domination Bush T-shirt on, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Cops on the back, Afghanistan, Iraq, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I'm mimicking these guys going, bawk, bawk, chicken hawk. And one of them is running down the barricade. He's a young guy, really mad. He goes to me. He says, oh, your belly's hanging over your belt. Like he was saying something profound. My butt off at him. I want to tell him how your brains are hanging out of your skull, but that would go over his head.
Yeah. And what was the other one, not the comic one, the most impactful moment?
The other one was when we got to Camp Casey. At the end of the rally,
yeah,
I met Anne Wright and I talked to her and I thanked her. You know, I was kind of like, I heard some rumors that Cindy and Jesse Jackson had gotten arrested. Turned out to be false, but there were these rumors going around. And I talked to her and I thanked her for her service, for being a true patriot. And she just really allayed my fears, and she told me everything was going to be all right. And I just felt inspired in the presence of a true patriotic woman. And it just made me feel like really good that we are really good. We're going to win.
Oh,
we
good.
It's going to take some time, but we are going to win.
Well, Rich Two Bagels, if people don't know, is one of our frequent audience members at our live broadcast. I'm glad you had an eventful time, and I'm glad you went down to show your support, Rich. And looking forward to seeing you in New Jersey, buddy.
I'll see you guys in November when I get back from Florida. Have a great time.
Oh, that's right, Florida. Right. You lucky bastard.
Enjoy yourself, man.
He's going to Florida. Oh, that's nice. Yeah, I wish I was going to Florida. So let's you want to take one more call here? No, we got a little. Let's hold on to him. We're going to take a few more calls from people that were down there over the weekend in Washington to fill us in on what they experienced at the march. We're going to also get into, obviously, we've got some stuff we want to talk about post-Rita. In terms of how Bush responded, what his plans are, he's being pitched heavily by the military to move disaster relief under the auspices of the Department of Defense, which I think would probably be, one step closer to a police state than we already are for a lot of different reasons. We're going to talk about that and much more in just a few minutes. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Hey, what's going on? It's 34 past the hour. You're listening to Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Morning Sedition here on Air America Radio. We're taking a few calls from people who were down there at the protest on Saturday. Dan Pashman was there. He's going to talk to us a little later. I was down there, but I was at the convention center following Dennis Kucinich doing some comedy for a very intimate group of people, a few of which walked out. And I think I've got an explanation coming from our next caller. Mike, how are you? What's going on, buddy? You there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, so, Mike. So, Mike, you were the one who was sitting right up front in my performance, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And your wife yanked your kids out of there.
Yes, she did. I thought it was the religion thing, but it wasn't. It was because you used the S word.
Yes, I used the slang for poop, and there I was saying there was no God and we're all screwed. But when I said the S word for poop, his wife got up and took the kids out. It's like, I don't care if he puts that idea that there's no God in their head, but this. So, Mike, did you go to the march?
Yes, I did.
And you had a good experience over there?
Yeah, it was great. We jumped in about the middle of the way, and there were a lot of people in front of us and a lot of people behind us. And we finished up at the end of the march, went over to Camp Casey, then went over by the Washington Monument, and found some bathrooms, came back, and decided to head for the metro, and we were still at the back of the march. I mean, there were still people just starting out. That's how many people were there.
Oh, wow, that's amazing. Well, thanks for calling, Mike.
One other thing.
Yeah.
Yesterday, we went over to Arlington Cemetery.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
My dad is buried over there, and he's buried in the new section because he was missing in action in Vietnam. And they just buried him in November of 2001. Well, after I went to his grave, I went over to look at all the young kids that are freshly buried.
Yeah.
It just struck me as, I don't know, I just was at a loss for words. I mean, here you have all these young kids there that are, their birthday years are 85 and 84, you know, and some of the graves are so new that they have just a little, you know, license decal or ID card up there, you know, saying, you know, this is temporary. And one was so new, it just had a stake there with a number written on it.
Oh, that's awful.
I couldn't believe, you know, and they're talking about honoring these soldiers. Where's the honor? They're dead.
Yeah, that's absolutely right, Mike. That's absolutely right. I appreciate your feelings there, man. Thanks for calling.
Thanks, Mike.
Yeah, well, that's, 1,914 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War. And that is exactly true. You know, what does it mean to honor the troops? I say the biggest honor we could give them is to bring them home as opposed to, dying in this useless war. Bill in Delaware, Vietnam vet, how are you?
Hey, Bill.
Yes.
How are you doing? Yeah, what's going on, man?
I've got one point.
Yeah.
I was in Vietnam in 1967.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only difference between this war and the war that I was in is that there's no draft. If there was a draft, you'd see protests in every city in America. You have no idea there's a war going on now. You can go in any city other than like Washington on this weekend. But normally, I remember when I came back, I couldn't believe the number of protesters. And I was against them then, and then I finally grew up and understood what they were doing.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think that if there were a draft and it did have that type of effect on every town and city across the country in terms of sacrificing their young men to go to a war because they had no choice, you're probably right. We would have seen millions of people all over the country, rising up in action.
The only thing we can do to support our troops instead of putting a bumper sticker on your car is all of us need to be paying a war tax or there needs to be a draft. Then you can say you support your troops.
I think that's an interesting point, that you have an administration that is unwilling to tax the most wealthiest people in this country or even make a tax adjustment so that number one, the country doesn't get back, you know, so far into debt that we'll never get out. And as far as the draft is concerned, I mean, it seems to me, Bill, that the way to really honor these guys, particularly in this conflict, would be to bring them home. All right. Well, I guess he dropped out there. I apologize about that. But I want to make it clear that not since August of 1968, the high point of the opposition to the war in Vietnam, has there been a majority of people in America who really believe that an ongoing conflict was wrong. And that is now happening in this country. Let's shift our focus a little bit to what's gone on in Texas and New Orleans over the weekend. Our next guest is the Dallas Bureau Chief for Time Magazine. She's been in the Gulf region covering the hurricane recently. She joins us to give us an update on the aftermath of Hurricane Rita. Good morning, Kathy Booth Thomas. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thanks, guys.
Good morning.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So what is the extent of the damage? I've heard a lot of different reports, but it seems that thankfully only one person, one fatality, right?
Right. That's all we've heard of so far. But, the problem with hurricanes is you don't get to the scene and find out where the real damage is for like 3 or 4 days afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Even the National Guard can't swim. So it takes a while to find out what the real damage is. The other thing I would note is that, you know, people keep saying nobody died in the storm, but a lot of people died trying to get the heck out of town.
Yeah, that was awful. It just seemed like complete chaos at the idea of a massive evacuation.
Right, and we're finding out every day. I just found out yesterday that there were other people who died on other buses, other elderly, who, because they were all evacuated in 100-plus heat.
So they were out of air condition. They didn't have, if they were on some sort of life support, they didn't have access to that. They didn't have the comfort and attention of medical orderlies. And then there was that one tragic explosion on the bus.
Right, but even, there's other ones that we're just now finding out. Yesterday I found out on Friday, very early Friday morning, a group from a nursing home was taken to East Texas. When they started getting off the bus, they found out that two of the nursing home residents on that bus had died from dehydration because it took so long for them to get out. So I have a feeling we're going to hear more stories like that because a lot of these, they went to East Texas, very small towns. We're just not hearing about those. So I kind of get angry when people say, well, only one person died. But, you know, a lot of people died trying to get away from the storm.
I didn't mean to make you angry.
No, I'm just kidding.
Kathy Booth Thomas, What has been FEMA's presence? You were in Houston the other day. What kind of presence is FEMA establishing in the town in terms of leading the evacuation effort and perhaps leading people coming back into the Houston area?
Well, FEMA hasn't had really a presence of leading them back. I mean, the state's taken more of that. But they are there. I mean, you know, everybody learned the lesson after New Orleans. They all got there. They all staged pretty quick. But, you know, to be honest, as much as we harp at them, the fact is that this storm moved a lot further east. So they were all staged west of Houston and Galveston. And then, of course, the storm really hit hardest again in western Louisiana. And just the eastern edge of Texas pretty much got spared. There's some flooding, yes, especially along the Trinity now, they're worried. But a lot of this was, you know, now the problem now is that they staged so far west that they're having to, like, chase the aftermath farther east. It's really back in Louisiana where they started.
So what I'm hearing is essentially, it's interesting. It seems that that FEMA and state and local officials not only prepared a little better in the face of Rita coming, but they over-prepared and created somewhat of a state of panic that was a little dangerous.
Well, you know, let's face it, they thought they were facing a Category 5, and if they had taken that face on, then Galveston and Houston today would be a lot different story.
Right.
But, yeah, now, you know, first, you know, in New Orleans we had the disaster aftermath that was kind of mangled, and now we know that we have to pay attention a little bit more to the disaster prep part of it, too, because getting, I mean, let's face it, that, you know, 2.7 million people fled that city in a really short order. I was driving down, though, when all of this was happening, and I got to tell you, it was frightening because I was driving into the city with all these people were driving the wrong way down the streets. They were driving in ditches.
Freaking out.
There was no gas. It was scary.
Kathy Booth-Thomas, you mentioned there was no gas. How badly were the oil refineries, in fact, affected if it didn't hit full force on them?
The early reports are that there's almost no damage at all, which is good news. Now, I would note one other thing is that, you know, it's not just the gasoline that's out there in the Gulf of Mexico. Half the natural gas in the United States comes out of the Gulf between Texas and Mexico. So I have a feeling a lot of people up north are going to be feeling it pretty bad this year because just everything's going to be delayed as a result of the storms, all the storms we're having. I mean, the season's not over yet.
So now, President Bush, I guess he stopped out down in San Antonio at Randolph Air Force Base, but he watched most of the events up from Northcom in Colorado. Was that perceived in a negative way by anybody you talked to down in Texas?
No, I think everybody kind of, I think it was pointed out to him that he might be getting in people's way. They might have to, you know, put more security on him.
You mean setting up photo ops and whatnot?
Pardon?
Setting up photo ops and whatnot?
No comment.
All right. Well,
I think he did get the message.
Okay. Well, Kathy Booth-Thomas from Time Magazine, Dallas Bureau Chief, great talking to you. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks a lot.
Thanks
a lot.
You take care. This is interesting because Bush is, I believe, being courted by the military to give them the reins in responding to not only terrorist attacks but natural disasters. Bush said he's interested. He's interested in this. He was updated or pitched, as I'd like to call it, about the federal response to Katrina by military leaders at Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And the main pitch was delivered by Major General John White, who I think was giving him a hard sell and basically saying, quote, we knew the coordination piece was a problem, unquote. He said basically that maybe there shouldn't have been five helicopters showing up to pull one guy out of a tree. And then I'm quoting Major General White again. That's the sort of simplistic thing we'd like to avoid. We're not maximizing the use of forces to the best efficiency. Certainly that was a train wreck we saw in New Orleans. At least with Rita, we had the benefit of time. With a national plan, we'll have a quick jump and opportunity to save more people, end quote. What he's doing is he's trying, I think there's momentum coming out of the Pentagon, to put disaster relief measures under the guidance of the Department of Defense. Now, my response to that is they have had 5 years. What have they been doing? If they had a response to a terrorist attack in place that would have worked, and now they want to move all responses into the Department of Defense, I mean, theoretically, with Homeland Security, with the Department of Defense, you know, supposedly, you know, churning away, working on how to, you know, counter, you know, terrorist attacks. And you would think if they had a model for the most extreme attack possible by a terrorist organization, or a single terrorist, that they could have easily applied that to what was going on in New Orleans and in Texas. I mean, these guys, it wasn't, they had plenty of time to know. This is hurricane country. I mean, if he hadn't gutted FEMA and pulled that cabinet Washington Post away. There might have been a more articulated plan, but to just give it over to the Department of Defense, to just put it into their hands and allow them to dispatch troops into any disaster zone and just keep people at bay, you know, arrest looters and frighten people on some level until they can get private contractors in that are playing ball with the administration, I think is a mistake. And I think to give them that responsibility is somehow, in my mind, a step closer to a police state in some respects.
Well, what we're seeing here is, as you mentioned, a full court press from the military. Now, the Department of Defense itself, Rumsfeld and them, are not all that enthusiastic about taking up this responsibility. But the military people on the ground are saying, look, we were unable to act, we were unable to function because of a law, by the way, that is in place that prohibits the military from doing domestic law enforcement. And that, I'm not sure that that's a firewall that ought to be taken down, quite frankly.
Yeah, I'll tell you, you know, Bush is trying to spin this like he was up at Northcom, he was down at the Air Force Base, he's saying, well, I'm taking notes, basically saying I'm doing a little research, I want to make sure we don't screw up again, and I don't give him a free pass. The bottom line is, I was told as an American citizen that something was being done in terms of Homeland Security, which should have easily applied to hurricane management. Now, the bottom line is, how safe are the cities? I'm sitting here thinking yesterday morning, I don't have a car. You know, I'm trying to figure out, you look at the evacuation plans for most major cities, they don't got one. Now, bottom line is, it's going to be difficult when you have a densely populated area of any kind. But when you look at the plans that are in place, which we will in a second, for cities like New York, Los Angeles, Boston, Philadelphia, Chicago, they got vague ideas. But you would think, where did all that Homeland Security money go that was being funneled into the states? Would they just put it in the bank account and use it for whatever they wanted? It seems that that's what happened, because they've had 5 years, this administration and Republican policymakers have had 5 years to deliberate some sort of planning on behalf of American cities, and it's not there. And I'm scared personally. I'm out there in Queens. If you know, Ray Kelly, the police commissioner, says that, you know, the one benefit we have is a subway system that carries 8 million people a day, and they think that that's going to be used to evacuate the city. Police, you can barely use some stations during rush hour. I mean, it's a very efficient station, a very efficient system, but it's not going to be used to evacuate people. So I'm out in Queens. I got no car. That means I've got two choices. Either I got to come back into the city to get to the mainland USA. I got to cross a bridge or go underwater or something. Or I got to go to the end of Long Island and jump in the ocean. All right. Those are my only options. What the hell am I going to do if something really bad happens? I got a gallon of water. I'm going to be, you know, fighting with, you know, people from around the world just to loot the bodega on the corner. And that's going to upset the Yemeni who owns it. I'm going to cause an international crisis in Queens.
Well, you know, this is a problem not just here in New York, but across the country, where it appears as though the Homeland Security money that was so generously handed out after September 11th has gone into people's general revenue funds. That's the only way that you could have no planning whatsoever, no plans in place, the money is still pouring in.
It's criminal. When we come back in just a second, we're going to talk about Ray Kelly's response. We're going to talk about the responses to that are in place for I don't know why he's laughing, but Brendan just died. I gotta know why he's laughing. But I'd like to go over what is in place for most major metropolitan areas, and it's very disturbing, folks. It's 49 past the hour, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Before past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Hope you're having a decent Monday morning. We're talking about how prepared is your city, our city, any city in this country to really, you know, act in some sort of organized fashion after a terrorist attack or any sort of disaster. And the results are baffling, folks, because I thought for the past 5 years, this administration with its Department of Homeland Security funneling money into different states, you know, disproportionately, obviously, which is a complaint that police commissioners Commissioner Ray Kelly has for New York. Why should they be getting a per capita money when New York is at the top of any terrorist list to hit? Why should they be getting less money per capita than, say, Vermont or Wisconsin or Wyoming? I mean, I don't get it, and I'm scared myself because, you know, you look at Los Angeles or San Francisco. Los Angeles basically has no plan for moving and sheltering large numbers of people who would be made homeless by an earthquake or something like that. Emergency response planners acknowledge that no plans exist for moving hundreds of thousands, potentially millions, of Southern Californians out of harm's way. No plan. They're just admitting it. We got nothing. We got nothing. At least, you know, being that I've lived in L.A., and I do live in L.A. sometimes, you know, I'm far enough east where I can just see the San Gabriel Mountain, so I could literally head for the hills if necessary. San Francisco, their evacuation plan depends in large part on the two main bridges that connect the city with Oakland to the east and Marin County to the north. And obviously, both are vulnerable to earthquake or explosions, anything. And the plans that they have in place call for use of fishing boats and ferries. Millions of people! It's like, yeah, we'll just get the fishermen to help out.
No, I don't think so.
Exactly. Boston is a little further along than most cities. You know why? Because they had the Democratic National Convention there. So they actually put a plan in place, you know, to protect that convention from a terrorist attack and if something would happen. So they actually have something in place because they had a practical application of it. But the rest of these cities, a lot of them have just been like, yeah, let's just put that Homeland Security money into a highway project. I mean, what the hell? What's going to happen?
Well, you know, it's interesting. New York has two different plans, one for a terrorist attack, one in the event of a natural disaster. But neither one is can really deal with the kind of wholesale numbers of people. I mean, you're talking about an island in Manhattan that has 10 million people on it at any given, between 10 and 12, on any given day. Moving that number of people is an extraordinary challenge.
Well, that's why the focus should be on, not unlike we heard about Cuba, the focus should be on having, you know, if they say that they're going to use schools as shelters, well, they should have a medical plan in place, a food distribution plan in place, a plan in place to deal with the elderly and deal with the sick and getting them into shelters so that it's quite obvious that everyone's not going to get out. So they should have a plan in place that would enable them to get the medical attention they need, the food and water that they need for an amount of time, and to get the people that need to be moved, the most vulnerable, to the shelters as quickly as possible. I mean, that's a plan. Evacuation, that's a tall order. If you want to call and share your experiences about you know, what you went through down at the protest in Washington, 866-303-2270 is our number. We're going to bring Dan Pashman in here in a second to talk about his experience and to talk about just the momentum of the anti-war movement in this country, which, despite what Carl Rove says, does exist. 57 past the hour. Six past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley.
Hi.
How are you, Mark? You all right?
I'm doing all right.
You got home from Washington okay? Did you get stuck in traffic? What happened?
No problems with traffic whatsoever. We came up yesterday, made a couple of stops along the way, and it was fine. There were no traffic problems at all.
I just want to tell people who are listening that not since August of 1968, the high point of the opposition to the Vietnam War, has there been a majority of people in America who believe that an ongoing conflict was wrong. On Sunday, people from around the country and the world came together in Washington to march in the largest anti-war protest in the Capitol since the U.S. invasion. And we are going to talk to Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, in just a minute. We're going to talk to you on the phones about your experiences down there on Saturday. But right now, if you're just tuning into the program, it's hard to figure out what the headlines are saying because, you know, there's so much crazy, you know, language and it's lies. And thank God we have the iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator to translate some headlines for us. So let's crank it up and feed it some headlines. From the Washington from the Washington, how's that still funny? Isn't that amazing? From the Washington Post. Bush, government was prepared for storm. Bush, government was prepared for storm. Translation. Bush, government was prepared for media storm. All right. From ABC News, it's like I'm going to stifle your laughter because I didn't think that one that was that good. Like, I'm not going to let you laugh because I've decided that I didn't like that one that much. All right. From ABC News, Iraq supporters rebut anti-war rallies. Iraq supporters rebut anti-war rallies. Translation, pro-delusion party stages rally in Cloud Cuckoo Land. Cloud Cuckoo Land, that's funny because it's got the alliteration and the repetition of the sounds. All right, here we go. I'm sorry, it's Deconstruction Day. It's Comedy Deconstruction Day with Mark. Here we go. From Indianapolis Star, Cheney aneurysm repaired successfully. Cheney aneurysm repaired successfully. Translation, Frankenstein repaired, resumes killing spree. Now, that one makes more sense. Now, you know, the anti-war movement was expecting about 100,000 people, according to the police chief down in D.C. They probably hit that, and that's what he said. They probably hit that. So if he's saying that, that means it was much more, because usually police and authorities are lowballing the number. And we've been talking to people who say that it's probably up around 250,000. Of course, there are those on the extreme left who say there was 1 million people there. But I think that who isn't on the extreme left? I'm of that ilk. But, you know, the numbers, we're just trying to make an average. You know, you were there, Dan. You say...
Yeah. I had it up around 1 million, Mark, actually.
You know, we're thinking like 200,000 between 150 and 300,000 people.
Yeah, my basic theory is if you take what the police say and then you take what the organizers say,
you
it's probably
it
in the middle.
Sure.
And so I figure at least 200,000.
Can we do that with the anti-war protesters, with the pro-war rally? They had 150 people in front of the FBI building. Then they say they had 400 down at a rally in some other part of the mall. So we average that out. They had about 200 people
right.
to our 200,000 people. So how's the country feeling? How you feeling, Dan Pashman?
I'm feeling good. How are you guys?
I'm all right. How was your experience down there? You actually, I was busy following Dennis Kucinich at the convention center and sales expo for earth oils and solar
right.
panels. And you were at the real thing.
I was
thing.
On the mall at the rally, and it was pretty great. It was a pretty moving experience. I mean, you and I, Mark, went together to the march here in New York City
yes.
around the time of the Republican convention, which was just about. Just over a year ago, I believe the Republican convention was September, it was like August 30th, 2004 was the rally.
It was the day after I got my cats out of the garbage.
There you go.
And that rally in New York, while there were a lot of people, and people certainly had their strong opinions, to me there was a certain feeling of I guess I would almost say hopelessness, like we didn't really think this was actually going to affect change.
Yeah, because our city had been taken over.
Right.
By Republicans.
And because we knew deep down, although we were loath to admit it, that back then we were still the minority.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe a large minority, but the anti-war side was the minority a year ago.
That's what I was telling you before the show. Is now
right.
when you wear an anti-Bush shirt back then, you really felt like you might get hurt. Now you're like, am I right? Yeah.
Right. There was a real sense of confidence at the rally in Washington, and a real sense of hope that we had turned a corner, and the people were walking with it with a passion and a confidence that we knew now we represented the majority of Americans, and that was a real turning point in the past year, and you could really feel it and sense it over the course of that amount of time.
And while all those people were marching in front of the White House, George Bush was at Northcom in Colorado looking at a control panel going, so if I just push this, the entire Eastern Seaboard goes?
Right. Then they'll all be red states.
Exactly.
Yeah. But I mean, it was quite an amazing scene, guys, to be, I climbed up to the base of the Washington Monument, which is up on a hill, and that kind of overlooked the area where the protest was, where the stage was, and to see the size of the crowd with the White House behind the crowd as mm-hmm. a backdrop was really pretty amazing to see these people that had come from all over the country, families who brought their kids. There were people just in our hotel who had brought their kids in from Chicago D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And to see all these people who had come, it was as if they had come right to Bush's doorstep. And it was quite a scene, really.
And just a picture of you at the base of the Washington Monument, probably holding a wrap sandwich of some
right.
kind. Wondering whether it was still good. I swear to God, we're going down the train. And the only thing Pashman was thinking about, we're going on Thursday night, so we get to the hotel. He's got a wrap that I think he's got half a sandwich that he brought with him.
Yeah.
Right?
So
he went to the ice machine at the hotel to get a bucket of ice to ice the half a sandwich down that he brought with him from here. And he was like, we're going out. He's like, you think it's going to be okay till tomorrow? And I'm like, I'm sure the sandwich will be, but I'm not sure about you.
Right.
I don't know if you're all right. I think you should be a medicine for this issue.
The sandwich was packed on ice.
I know. Did everything work out?
Well, you know, we got that sandwich from Cozy, so I ended up keeping that one. So I actually chucked the other half. Not even because I thought it went bad, but because I thought it might have gotten waterlogged.
See, you're now seeing the two compartments in the past in mind. There's one compartment that's always going like, when is that sandwich going to be okay, and how can I fortify myself in a few minutes?
Right,
yeah,
right.
I guess we all have that. Let's talk to some people about something other than food. We're talking to people who were taking calls who were at the march. We got Larry down in Virginia streaming us. How was the march for you, Larry?
Well, it was really something. I'm just wondering, how many people does it take to make Washington, D.C. look like Shanghai, China,
yeah,
in rush hour? You know, that was a whole bunch of folks.
Yeah, I'll say.
And about the 400 people that were up there at the thing on Sunday, I'm wondering if it's the same 400 people I was exchanging wedding vows with on Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Some of that sounded pretty good, and I'm straight.
So Larry, you're a veteran yourself?
Yes, I'm a Vietnam veteran, and I was on Kerry's boat, and I'm not lying to you.
Oh, really?
The boat I was on, the boat I'm talking about, is the USS Gridley.
Uh-huh.
I got on about 2 years after he got off, and I didn't even know that till last year at the election. I thought, oh, that's cool. I guess that's why nobody paid me to lie about it.
Oh, okay.
There you go.
But you wouldn't.
Anyway, my best good deed for the day on that day is I kind of helped a guy carry a banner. It was ended up me and three nice little primary school teachers, and we walked that banner all the way to the end of the parade. And we found out we'd all relieved somebody else, so we had no idea who owned the banner.
So you got a banner at
home. We sent it over to Camp Casey on the theory that they would not refuse it. They didn't.
And what did the banner say, Larry?
It said, bring the troops home now.
Okay, man. Well, thanks.
Sentiments exactly.
Thanks so much for calling,
thanks, Larry.
Yeah, it was fun looking at all the different signs. You know, liberals are pretty creative.
Did you lose the track of what he was saying somewhere in the middle?
Yes.
Yeah. Was there a wedding, and then there was a Sunday, and then there was 400 people, and we all just sort of like, uh-huh. You know, he had nice things to say.
Was that like a gay wedding or something? He said something about, I'm straight. So I don't know how that actually factored into
the
overall
story.
Well,
there's nothing we can do about it now. So you were about to talk to us about T-shirts and stuff you saw. I think we can hold that thought. Let's take one more call. We got Debbie calling from New Jersey. How are you, Debbie?
Hey, Debbie.
Hello.
Hello. Well,
how are you doing? Oh, it was great. There was so many people there. There was at least 200,000. And just before the march started, which started a little late, it actually got off at 3 o'clock. But before that, somewhere around in between noon and 2 o'clock, it was announced that the police had shut down the metro.
Huh.
Because there were so many protesters coming into the town, they shut it down.
What, the entire system?
Yes.
I heard
they
that, too.
They weren't letting any more people into the town.
But this happened all on the Eastern Seaboard, right?
I don't know about that.
I got dispatches from the margin that said that they were blaming some sort of electrical problem of shutting down Amtrak trains all the way up to Boston. And I don't know if anyone can validate that.
Yeah.
But
Rachel Maddow validated it on her show. Apparently, Amtrak dropped a beam off of a crane, and it fell onto a wire, and it shut down all of the train service.
Karl Rove.
Yeah.
All right, Karl Rove.
Smells like a conspiracy to me.
Dropping beams on the wire. Huh? What's that, Debbie?
They will spare no.
Exactly. If you get pictures of Karl Rove, he was probably up on a bridge with that beam, just in his diaper, going, But anyways, Debbie, so you had a good time.
I had a great time. There were people there with their babies in their backpacks walking down the road. There were people that looked like there were 110 in wheelchairs and everybody in between.
Okay, you mean the kind of backpacks where the kid's head comes out, not just stuffed in. stuffed into the pack under a shirt or
a Ziploc bag.
Yeah, right.
It was incredible. Cindy was there. She spoke. I went to Camp Casey. I got my T-shirt.
Oh, good.
Another thing, that a lot of the park rangers, they were shutting down people that were selling T-shirts because apparently now it's illegal to do that on the park lawn.
Yeah, well, they should have been giving them away.
What, anyway. Are they crazy?
So that's what started to happen. There was a fellow there. He had these really great T-shirts. They were nice, bright yellow.
Yeah.
He said, make levies, not war.
Nice.
Yeah.
Would you wait, Pashman? Wait, hold on a minute, Debbie. What's the one you saw, Pashman? I like that one.
The T-shirt that I saw?
Yeah, the exit strategy
the
one.
The rapture is not an exit strategy.
Well, Debbie, thanks for calling. It's nice having you on.
Okay, you too, man. Have a great day.
You too. Right, bye-bye. That's very clever. I like the rapture.
I like that one a lot. I also liked one that was a variation on a theme that we've seen before, but it was I can't say the word, but it was Clinton bleeped an intern, Bush bleeped the country.
Yeah.
All right, well, look, you know, it sounds like, of course, that people should be allowed to sell their T-shirts. Some people sell their shirts just to get around. You meet people, like, at protests and stuff who are like, they're just trying to make their nut to get back to wherever they're coming from by selling the T-shirt.
Right.
But that's really petty. The Rangers, Park Rangers, could think to do is wander around the rally and shut down guys selling silkscreen T-shirts they made.
Yeah, although I did see some really irritating people that I almost started a conversation with that were selling T-shirts that said, "Stop bitching, start a revolution." And I wanted to be like, dude, you're selling T-shirts. What are you doing? You know, why do you sell T-shirts that say, "Stop selling T-shirts, start a revolution"?
Because it's the T-shirt revolution, man.
That's right.
Don't you get it?
We got Robert Reich coming up in a little while, and we're also going to talk a little bit about how fuel costs. This is an interesting one. How fuel costs are affecting education. Dig that, and we'll get into that in a second. It's 18 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition.
MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Good morning. It's Monday, I know, but you're doing all right, right? You okay? You all right? It's Morning Sedition with Mark Maron, and that's Mark Riley.
Hey.
This is Air America Radio. No, Mark, we got another call from management.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, they're saying this show has to make more money so we can have real phones instead of the ones that moo when we dial the picture of a cow. And, of course... It's nice when you read the joke that you haven't read before and you realize it's a joke in the middle. All right, anyways, and of course the company has to pay for enough rose petals to cover the floor of Al Franken's office. You know, that's going to cost a lot of money because that's a day-to-day thing. Got to switch that up every couple of days. So that's why we now present today's Product Placement Minutes. Riley, what's today's product placement story?
One of the worst war criminals of the Bosnian Serb War is now in custody and faces charges of crimes against humanity.
And these three young women are undressing you because...
Oh, well, Mark, this is Sandra, Kiko, and Maria from the Arliss General Day Spa of Staten Island. I'm getting a free treatment body wrap, waxing the works. I think we're starting with a facial. Srejohe Lukcik turned himself in last week to the Serbs after having been on the run since the late 1990s. He was in a paramilitary group called the Avengers that allegedly killed Bosnian Muslim civilians, including women, children, and the elderly.
Mm, wow, pure evil. And what are they putting on your face right now?
Well, Mark, they're wiping it down with Dr. Hauschka cleansing milk. Then they'll apply a naturopathic green tea wasabi mask.
Uh-huh. And while we're talking about cleansing, what sort of ethnic cleansing is Lukic accused of?
Among other things, the Avengers supposedly barricaded about 70 Bosnian Muslim women, children, and elderly men into one room where they set off a firebomb.
Oh, my God. That's the worst thing I've ever heard. And how's that facial working out for you?
Well, I feel all the tension leaving my body.
Oh, good for you, Riley. Good for you.
The indictment says this group did the same kind of thing less than 2 weeks later. About 70 people died each time.
And now you're getting a body wrap?
Oxygenated seaweed with pressure point massage. It detoxifies, leaving your skin firmer and eliminates water retention.
And the war crimes trial?
Lukic will be extradited to The Hague in the Netherlands.
You know, people forget war criminals are still on the loose from that war, including Bosnian Serb leader Radovan Karadzic. So for the benefit of a lot of listeners who may be wondering, are you still going to get that waxing?
Well, just the bathing suit area. Ah!
Thanks. That was today's Morning Sedition product placement. All right. It's fun for Monday. It's okay to have fun on Monday. So listen to this. When gas prices spiraled out of control after Katrina, Georgia Governor Sonny Perdue suspended the state's gas tax, saving motorists about 15 cents a gallon. That suspension will be in effect until next Saturday. Now he has a new plan. He called for the state schools to take two early snow days and cancel classes today and tomorrow. He says it will save 250,000 gallons of diesel each day that would be used for buses, not to mention the fuel saved by moms and teachers not having to take the extra trip. He also said that electricity would be saved as well. Well, that's great. Let's just stop sending kids to school altogether. Homeschool them for, you know, however you want. Don't if you don't want to. This is exactly what Bush means by states taking the initiative. This is a sad state of affairs, Riley.
Well, it's a sad state of affairs. I'm curious, you know, what happens if the price doesn't go down? Which I don't think it will. It may moderate a little bit, but I think we've kind of reached a certain plateau, a certain level that these things are going to cost for the foreseeable future. So it's not like you take the time off now and then later on further down the road they'll be paying less. They're still going to pay the same amount.
Right, and there's a school system in Kentucky that's shortening the school week to 4 days. Now, this has got to be a policy problem. How is it that kids are paying with their education for this for these gas prices, Riley?
Well, because in most instances, you find state administrations that are very hesitant to do anything on their level. You know, they're taking a chunk out of state taxes. They got to make up the revenue shortfall somehow or another.
Well, we're going to talk to former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich in just a few minutes, and he'll maybe shed some light on some of this stuff, because this seems like the wrong way about going, you know, to cut corners to save money around gas prices. It's horrible. It's 27 past the hour. Stay tuned for Robert Reich. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
In 1865, the SS Republic, carrying a fortune in gold and silver coins, sank nearly 1,700 feet to the bottom of the Atlantic. The ship's precious cargo was lost for almost 140 years. After an extensive deep ocean search, the shipwreck was discovered by Odyssey Marine Exploration. And right now, you can own these collectible coins, bottles, and astonishing artifacts, all carefully recovered and preserved from this historic shipwreck, by calling toll-free 800-306-5122 or by visiting shipwreck.net. This is your chance to own a rare part of nautical history. Quantities are extremely scarce, so call today to learn how you can own a piece of valuable treasure. Call 800-306-5122. That's 800-306-5122 or visit shipwreck.net.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Man, I just had one of those—you know, one of those yawns you don't think you're going to get out of. Like it might go on forever. Like it's just a yawn that starts. You're like, oh my god, I'm in trouble. Oh god, it's not going to stop.
And your jaw locks.
Yeah. I can't be like this all the time. Maybe it's just Monday. Hey, we know. Listen, folks. Robert Reich is going to be here momentarily. We got the morning remembrance coming up. There's still a lot of show is going to happen before your very ears. We know a lot of people are out of work and spending Sunday leafing through the want ads or monster.com. We want to help be part of the solution, not part of the problem. So here's our Morning Sedition Monday Help Wanted listing. That's it. Background. You may have heard the National Enquirer said that George Bush is secretly drinking again. We didn't know whether to believe it or not, but then we saw this ad. Wanted, discreet bartender. We have an immediate opening for a bartender in a very private club. If selected, you will be tending bar in the world's most exclusive drinking establishment. Membership, 1. Be aware, although the clientele is just one individual, you should be prepared to handle problem behavior. There's a baseball bat beneath the bar. Enough said. The ideal candidate will be able to listen to endless stories about the wild times in the Air National Guard, or the wild times away from the Air National Guard. And just in case, you should also be prepared to discuss domestic issues and foreign policies if the subjects come up. Don't worry, they won't. Your client has special needs. Absolutely no pretzels are to be served. And under no circumstances is he to be permitted to use the phone. Also, you should be prepared to spend up to 6 months a year in Crawford, Texas. The bar is located several stories beneath 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. To apply, come around the back, ask for Carl. There you go. Okay, folks, here we go. Hurricanes Katrina and Rita have not only done damage to the Gulf Coast, they've also done damage to the entire country's economy and infrastructure. Joining us now to help us understand the long-term impact of these two major disasters is one of our favorite guests. We haven't talked in a while. He served as a labor secretary during President Clinton's first term. He's currently a professor of social and economic policy at Brandeis University and the author of Reason, Why Liberals Will Win the Battle for America. Please welcome back to Morning's Edition, Robert Reich. Good morning, Robert.
Hello, Mark. Hello, Mark.
Good morning. How you doing?
It's nice to have you.
I'm doing just great.
It's nice to have you back. So after Katrina, Bush pledged about $200 billion in aid to the Gulf region. Now, where is this money going to come from, Secretary? I don't understand.
Well, it's going to be probably borrowed. The federal deficit is already pretty large. The president wants to continue to try to extend his tax cuts, mostly for, you know, to the rich, and get rid of the estate tax, which goes to the top 1%. He's going to, you know, he says he's going to continue to try to do that. Meanwhile, of course, we're spending like mad in Iraq. Now, where is all this money going to come from? It comes from borrowing. We borrow mostly from East Asia these days.
China?
China is a big lender to us. That's absolutely right. And we're going to go deeper and deeper into HOC.
So does that mean that they could repo the states?
Well, obviously, as China, you know, lends us more and more money, we are more and more dependent on China, as well as we are dependent on Japan. It's not that bad to be dependent on another country, but it does mean that we have certain limitations in terms of foreign policy.
Professor Reich, maybe you can help me out and connect a few dots for me. We're seeing now the cleanup of Hurricane Katrina, following Hurricane Katrina, and we've seen the federal government in pretty rapid succession provide a waiver from the provisions of the Davis-Bacon Act, waivers on affirmative action. 80%, according to one published report, of the bids that have been let so far have been no-bid contracts. What does all of this, I mean, I'm a cynical guy, and maybe I'm wrong about what all this means, but what does it mean as far as you're concerned?
Well, it means that the federal government is not willing to use its huge bargaining power when it comes to no-bid contracts with big companies. I mean, it's essentially with Halliburton and with Shaw and with Fluor and other big companies, the government is saying, you guys just do what you want to do, essentially. We'll try to supervise you, but you bill us for the cost of it, and you add some profits to that, and we'll accept that. We're not going to use the competitive market. We're not going to bid one against another. It's basically we like you guys. Maybe for political reasons, you just go ahead and do the rebuilding. But when it comes to the actual workers who are going to do the rebuilding, the government is saying, no, we want the lowest wages possible. We're going to suspend something called the Davis-Bacon Act, which usually requires the federal government to pay prevailing wages in an area and not use its huge bargaining power to undermine wages. We're going to suspend the Davis-Bacon Act, and we're going to say the lowest wages possible.
So, in essence, they are going against what is a tenet of conservatism, which is encouraging a free market by utilizing cronyism, even if the companies that are doing the jobs may not be the best at doing those jobs. And they're exploiting immigrant workers, the most disenfranchised of this country's population, to do the work.
That's it. You got it.
So now let's talk a little bit more, because I'm sort of fascinated by this. You said that there were going to be limitations in foreign policy because of our debts to China. What does that look like, Robert?
Well, China is a 3,000-pound gorilla, obviously. China right now is building up its military. Not necessarily a bad thing. I mean, the military is very tiny, so building up a military from almost nothing is not necessarily a threat to us. But the Bush administration is obviously worried about China. It needs China's cooperation with regard to North Korea. It needs China's cooperation with regard to not being too pushy on the border of China and in India. Remember, India has a nuclear bomb. China presumably would like to have that, is worried about India. China is also the biggest economy in the region. Japan is still bigger, but China, at the greatest growing, is going to be the biggest economy in the region in a few years. So to be dependent, as we are financially, to make China one of our biggest creditors is not such a good idea if we want to have a little bit of diplomatic power.
Professor Rush, does that mean that the next time a Chinese firm wants to buy into an American oil company, it's actually going to happen? Like, it didn't happen with UNOCAL when the Chinese oil company tried, but does this mean that maybe they've got more leverage now?
Well, they certainly are going to have more and more leverage. And as the, you know, the irony here is that we tell the Chinese they've got to push their currency upward relative to the dollar. Because they, you know, we say it's just not fair to have a currency that allows them to export so much to us and we to export so little to them. But as they push their currency up relative to the dollar, it means that everything that we own becomes even cheaper to them, which means that they could buy more and more of America.
Oh my! You know, I'm going to not panic. So
no. Look, it's not. China is not our enemy. We need China, but the fact of the matter is that, like in so many other areas, the Bush administration just is not thinking through the implications of what they want
of this debt.
And you know, this administration. I'll tell you, and I know you are a nonpartisan.
Absolutely,
totally nonpartisan.
Right down the middle.
I don't want to add to the, you know, to get your reputation for nonpartisanship a little skewed. But this administration is brilliant at politics, but when it comes to actually implementing anything like the Iraqi war, going after Al Qaeda, mm-hmm. Katrina, whatever it is, they are the most ham-fisted group since the administration of Warren G. Harding.
Well, they just say that they are doing things and they don't really do them. I guess that's what being good at politics is and being governing is bad.
Well, they say they're going to provide a $200 billion for Katrina and for the rebuilding, but they really, if you look where the money is going to go, most of that money is going to go to these big contractors. Very little is going to trickle down to individual people, and the people who need it most are not even there in New Orleans anymore. They're scattered around, you know, basically the poor of New Orleans are now all over America. How in the world the administration is going to find them, I don't know. If they're concerned about finding them, but they keep on talking about rebuilding New Orleans as if the place was more important than the people.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the maybe lesser seen ramifications of this policy and also of this disaster, because we just read an article about the governor of Georgia, you know, taking extra days off of school to save fuel, it's forcing states and individuals to make sacrifices that is really because of bad policy, is it not?
Yeah, that's bad policy. I mean, look, you got a lot of states, a lot of locales that don't have the money. The federal government is there because we are a nation. We are a nation that is a national community. To require that the locales try to spend money where they have low tax bases is just silly. We do need a strong federal government to do what needs to be done in a nation state.
Do you think that making FEMA a cabinet post again would be a step in the right direction?
Honestly, not. I don't, Mark. It's just rearranging the deck chairs.
Okay.
It's just another reorganization box. I mean, what we need is effective people. We don't want cronies who are running the Food and Drug Administration, who are running FEMA, who are running every other agency. I mean, it may be good politics, but it means you have lousy administration.
Can I ask you about this? Now, the repercussions of this debt. I mean, how much of the future, like, because when the new the Democratic president in 2008 takes control, how much, we'll figure out who that's going to be later. You have any ideas?
Well, I can tell you one of 12.
Uh-huh. Okay. You?
No.
Oh. Al Gore?
It's possible. It's possible. But look, you are right to be concerned that there's going to be a huge mountain of debt. It happened when Bill Clinton and his cabinet took over in 1993. I was there. I was in charge of his economic transition.
Yeah.
We didn't even know how large the federal deficit was until we looked into it, and the first George Bush administration actually mounted created a mountain of debt that made it difficult for us Democrats, the Clinton administration, to do anything. I think this is exactly what this George W. Bush administration is going to do as well. You create so much debt, and you give so much contracts, so many awards to your cronies, corporate welfare, whatever it is, you make it difficult for any future Democratic administration to get out from under the debt.
Now, Professor, it seems as though...
I'm not cynical. I hope I don't sound cynical.
No, that's okay. But there seem to be some people in Congress. I saw John McCain on TV yesterday saying, essentially, and these are Republicans, that, you know, the debt has to be trimmed down, that somehow you've got to get this under control. He talked about, you know, trimming some of the pork from the highway bill. Any real possibility that they're going to trim $24 billion worth of member perks from this highway bill?
No. Those perks, that's corporate welfare, that's pork, they're not going to get rid of that. Unfortunately, what Bush wants to do, and what some Republicans want to do, is cut food stamps, cut Medicaid, cut housing for the poor. Look, there's a much more direct way of paying for Katrina, and that is, as exactly you said, get rid of the pork in that huge $260 billion highway bill. There's at least $40 billion of pork in there. And then, if that doesn't do the trick, just raise taxes on the rich.
Well, I think that part of the misunderstanding is that this administration is not using the word pork. They're like, get rid of the poor.
Yeah, that's right. If you tell them get rid of the pork, they hear get rid of the pork.
Thank you, Robert Rice.
That's right. They have a little bit of a hearing. So keep at it. Keep saying it. Maybe they'll get it out.
Okay. Thank you very much, Secretary Rice. Great talking to you.
Okay, Mark.
Take care now.
Bye-bye.
So I'll tell you, this is interesting because the Al Gore for president thing, that didn't come out of my head. My buddy Andy Ostroy over at the ostroyreport.blogspot.com, you know, got on the tip of this like last week. And I was just sort of like, wow, that is possible. The guy's all full of juice. He could be the comeback kid. I'm kind of curious about that. We'll keep a pulse on that if we can.
Oh, yeah.
Coming up next, we got Morning Remembrance. It's 47 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
It's 52 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition. Good morning. I know it's Monday, but it's okay. Listen to the nice music. Unfortunately, it's that time of week again, folks, when we here at Morning Sedition take a moment at this time of sorrow to reflect in our morning remembrance.
As the people of a grieving nation come together to mourn, to remember, and finally to find hope, Morning Sedition joins with them to mourn, remember, and find hope as well. And so we bring you the stories of those who have lost their lives, those who inspire us to carry on. Here now is Morning Sedition grief correspondent, Mort Mortensen.
Oh, no. First of all, I'd like to thank Penelope for those nice handkerchiefs she sent.
Oh, that's
very
nice of you.
Sweet of her. Daniel Rouge, White House physician for President Reagan. Daniel Rouge, the man chosen to be Ronald Reagan's White House physician during his first term as president, died tragically last month of a ruptured gipper. Early in his career, Rouge practiced medicine with First Lady Nancy Reagan's stepfather, who taught him the family secrets of pre-death facial embalming.
You're right? Yeah, okay.
I've been doing okay, thanks a lot.
Yeah.
After the 1981 assassination attempt on Reagan, Rouge remained at Reagan's side and nursed him back to health with the president's favorite vegetable dish, baked ketchup. Ketchup that's baked. Rouge never stayed for the second term, Mark, having been asked to leave after making the mistake of giving the president a battery of diagnostic tests in 1984 and then declaring him brain dead. Oh, God.
It's all right. It must be the new studio dust and whatnot.
What you need in here is an Oreck vacuum cleaner.
Yeah, we'll look into it.
Get into an Oreck vacuum cleaner! Dr. Rouge requested his body be dug up every year, examined by doctors, and declared fit enough to serve public service.
You all right?
Yeah.
I tell you to blow your nose, but we got no time.
I know.
All right.
All right. Thank goodness for Penelope's nice handkerchiefs.
Yeah, we'll use it at the end.
Okay. Sid Luft, Judy Garland's third husband. Sid Luft, the former Hollywood producer and Judy Garland's third husband, is now over the rainbow and under 6 feet of dirt. Luft is widely credited with being responsible for Garland's comeback in the 1950s, as well as being the only man to ever love her who wasn't gay. Before the couple's marriage, Luft had a reputation as a heavy drinker and barroom brawler, and even claimed to have broken four noses in various altercations. No, wait, that's Judy Garland. When Luft first met Garland, the singer was addicted to drugs, beset with depression, and perhaps most disturbing at all, of all, still accepting phone calls from Mickey Rooney. Yeah, I have him on the show, Mickey Rooney.
Yeah, he'd be great.
He's a riot.
He is hilarious.
Oh, gosh, so sad. Family members are consoling themselves with the thought that right now, Sid's up in heaven with David Guest's original eyebrows.
Wow. Why don't you go ahead and blow your nose now, because it's running and it's starting to...
Hey, thanks.
And that's Penelope's handkerchief. Now, what do you get those? You have to get those pressed and cleaned now?
I send that to the Air America Radio dry cleaning service.
Oh, that we have right here, yeah. You just put it in a bag that hangs on all our doorknobs.
State of the art.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the studio, state of the art. Yeah, yeah. You know why?
Why?
Because of the Oric vacuum cleaner.
Are you getting money on the side?
Get it, you an Oric. We know how to suck. The dirt. The dust particles off of it.
Yeah.
Oh, man. This, I just want to say, hey.
Yeah. You want to wrap it up? Or
yeah, I'm going to wrap it up right now.
You
want to
do it in the way that you usually do? Or?
Sure, okay. This has been this week's Morning Remembrance. Till next week, this is Mort Mortensen and Zane. Who's chopping onions?
Oh, man. That's terrific, Mort. Just great.
Hey, thanks, man.
Yeah. Let's stay in character right up to the break this time.
All right.
After
you coming over tonight for some Triscuits and coffee?
Sure, man. I didn't know I was invited, but certainly Triscuits and coffee. Who could turn that down? That sounds great. Are you Catholic, Mort?
Yeah, only on Fridays.
All right. Well, you know, here's a question. We're going to ask for callers on this, too, and we're going to tell you a little bit of a story. The Catholic Church, the Vatican, now wants to ban celibate homosexuals from being able to be in the priesthood. That means this is self-proclaimed homosexuals who don't practice sex. What the hell is the difference between that and regular celibacy? And what is wrong with the Catholic Church? We're going to get into that in a second, so stay with us. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Six past the hour. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. Good morning, Mark Riley. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing all right.
Yeah.
Hit the control program one. There you go.
Yeah. How you doing, man?
So,
it's interesting. We're still getting used to our new studio. We're still learning how to work everything. There's a lot of the movement going around, getting the hang of all the new buttons. So sometimes it'll be a little glitchy.
Yeah. Well, you know what happened? Crystal Presto moved into the other room. And I think every now and then you have to kind of switch stuff up in order for the room.
Yeah, so here we go. Let's crunch some numbers here that are very sad numbers. At least 1,914 members of the U.S. military have died since the beginning of the Iraq War. Just on Sunday, over the weekend, five Americans were killed in a helicopter crash in Afghanistan. A suicide bomber swerved a sedan across a highway medium and detonated it alongside a police convoy in southeast Baghdad today, killing 25 people dead and dozens wounded. That war is out of control, and that is why, in this country, we are seeing such a tremendous tilt in the public's approval of George Bush's overall handling of the situation in Iraq. At this point, 67% disapprove of the way Bush has handled this situation. That means a 32% approval rating, and he certainly saw this over the weekend down in D.C. at the big protest, where a police chief there in D.C., the assumption was the anti-war protesters were expecting 100,000 people, and the D.C. police chief said, quote, "I think they probably hit that," end quote, and those guys like to lowball. And the protesters themselves are saying anywhere from 250,000 to 300,000 people showed up. So let's cut it down the middle. Let's make an average. Let's make it around 200,000
people. 200,000
people,
the biggest anti-war protest since the summer of 68.
Yeah, and the ironic thing is here is that they were expecting about 20,000 pro-war ralliers to show up, and about 150 showed up in front of the FBI building. And then it's written that about 400 showed up at some minor protest on the mall somewhere. I don't even know where. So let's average that out. Let's say about 200 pro-war ralliers showed up in the midst of 200,000 anti-war protesters. A monumental show. Certainly a spit in the face of Karl Rove, who said there is no anti-war movement. And we got some really great stories over the last couple hours from people who were down there. It was a very moving event. A lot of kids, a lot of people from all different social statuses, from all different ethnic backgrounds showed up in unification, Republicans and Democrats, to protest this war and to try to bring those the troops home, and some calling for impeachment for what I believe is certainly homicidal genocide in both the war homicidal negligence on behalf of this president in light of the war and in light of his reaction to these hurricanes. Now, Rita, we just talked to Kathy Booth Thomas, Dallas Bureau Chief of Time Magazine. The report that one person has died in the aftermath of Rita might be too quick to call, in the sense that they haven't, as she pointed out, a lot of people were bussed out in a lot of chaos, elderly, sick people put on buses, and there was a huge, massive migration that was not that successful, but a little chaotic, could use a little work, but some people, a couple of elderly people died on the buses just from exhaustion and dehydration, and we shouldn't overlook that. But all in all, the damage after Rita was certainly nothing like Katrina, though a levee did break in the Ninth Ward there in
the lower Ninth Ward, yeah, in New Orleans, yeah.
And that reflooded that area, but that area was pretty much abandoned and is going to be damaged for many years to come.
Well, what we've seen here is a response that took the earlier response into consideration and therefore couldn't or shouldn't under any circumstances have been as bad as the first response. Yet the fact remains that FEMA, the federal agency that's charged with handling a lot of this, found that they still are running into the kinds of technical glitches that plagued Katrina, not having the proper information about people. There were folks who were supposed to be coming in as responders, directly working for FEMA, becoming federal employees. They weren't able to do so because of glitches within FEMA's own bureaucracy. So there are still a lot of problems with our emergency management system in this country, whether it's dealing with natural disasters or, in theory, dealing with a terrorist attack.
Dig this, Catholics. Gay priests are out even if they're not out. Non-practicing homosexuals who are practicing priests may be barred from the clergy. The Vatican is likely going to try to bar celibate gay priests from the priesthood. And it's assumed that the language they will be using, the Vatican, will connect homosexuality with pedophilia, and it will be characterizing homosexuals as being as much a part of the same scourge that almost brought the church down in this country. The Vatican seeks to rid the church of perhaps some of its best priests, like in the case of Reverend Michael Judge, the fire department, the New York Fire Department priest, who was a celibate, admitted homosexual. He died in the rubble of 9/11 after administering last rites to firefighters. This is a man who ministered firefighters, their wives, AIDS patients, the homeless, Flight 800 victims' families. He was a member of a gay Catholic group. He fought for gay rights and held services for gays. At his funeral, Giuliani called him a saint, and there actually is a campaign for his canonization. Now, as you were saying, Riley, some conservative admirers within the church are saying that they don't see the relevance of judging this guy on his sexual preference if it is not enacted upon, and it shouldn't even be an issue.
Well, yeah, because what you have here are many conservatives, certainly in New York, who were familiar with Father Judge's work over four decades, we're talking about now, 40 years. And what they're saying is, look, if you're going to start banning celibate gay priests, if you're going to start saying that the work of, for example, a straight priest who might have an affair with a married woman, which is also going on right here in New York, if that is at least worthy of keeping the guy on, but on the other hand, a celibate gay priest cannot do good works for the Catholic Church, there's a serious problem there.
Well, the interesting conversation that we had, and that it, you know, Brendan P.W. McDonald was brought up Catholic and actually has dedicated part of his life to understanding why that's wrong.
A lot of that came through Jesuit education as well.
Yeah, there you go.
But we had this conversation is that, you know, when you have somebody who is as capable as someone like Reverend Judge, as efficient and as giving as a priest could possibly be in the modern world, what the hell difference should it make whether or not he's gay or not, especially if he's not practicing? Now, one of the problems we had last night in talking about this is you have to give credibility on some level in making an argument to the stand of the church on homosexuality, because it was my assumption that the way the church controls one's brain is that by saying that, look, a sin is a sin, but God says homosexuality is wrong. Enacted or not enacted, if you're having the thoughts, it's wrong. So now our argument, or the thing that we want to discuss with Catholics out there in the world, 866-303-2270, is that in a modern Catholic church, what difference should it make if the priest is a great priest and he is celibate either way?
You know, and Mark, I think the interesting thing, and we'll see when we get some calls in on this, I think most Catholics will tell you it doesn't matter.
Right.
That it's that, well, it doesn't matter to me if he's gay, but you just said, then you have to at least honor the fact that they have something against homosexuality in the first place.
Right.
But putting that aside,
yeah,
they're still saying, well, but, you know, he's doing good deeds. He's a, you know, honorable person. Why should I care whether or not he's gay or not? Gay or straight, celibate is celibate. And that just enrages me that you're still saying, but yeah, I'm still part of this church. I still agree with, like, this is a time to say, no, I don't buy what you're selling, and I believe, I am a Christian, I believe in the doctrine that you preach, but I don't believe in these rules that you're legislating, basically. This is the same as, like, a lawmaker passing something down.
But isn't this a situation with something as broad as the Catholic Church in the level of different congregations have different approaches to it? I mean, there are different types of Catholic groups that do it differently. They do not honor the Mass, they do not honor some of these dispatches from the Vatican. Some there are gay masses.
Sure, but then when you're openly flouting your boss's orders, what organization are you really a part of?
Right.
I mean, then we're looking at all the things that led to the Protestant Reformation in the first place.
So you say we need a new Reformation.
Or you need to just stand up and say, no, I'm not going to be part of this.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting because people like the founder of the St. Michael website, Bert Kern, said, quote, if you look at the work and life of Michael Judge, this is a man who should be on the recruiting poster for Catholic priests. He was a great priest. According to a very questionable source inside the Vatican, a conservative estimate would be that 50% of the senior church officials and cardinals are gay. I'm not going to give validation to that source.
I think it's true. I'm not saying this flippantly. I think that's true.
And as opposed to and practicing as opposed to gays who are just teases is about 30%.
Oh God, that's awful.
All right, and that's this is from Grant. I'm not going to quote a source because I got it. We got it off a website, but you know it is out there and it seems reasonable. What do you think?
Yeah, well, right? I mean, the question here is, what is a deal breaker for a Catholic? The fact is that more than half of the Catholic practicing Catholics don't have a problem with abortion. In other words, have a problem with the Catholic Church's position on abortion. Yet they, in some cases, they get abortions, but they remain Catholics. Why?
Well, because they feel guilty and they are in a constant state of asking for release from those sins. That's part of the trick of how Catholics keep Catholics, is that you do something that you know is wrong because you have to do it, and then you're in deeper into the church because you've got a lot of forgiveness to ask for.
Yeah, but you could always go, you know, disentangle yourself from the Catholic Church and seek forgiveness someplace else.
Right. But you underestimate the mind that they put on these people.
But that's what people have to ask themselves, though, is if you were in an organization, when you walked in, forget about it being a religious organization, if you walked in the doors and they said, oh, by the way, no gays of any kind are allowed to step foot through this door, even though you like everything else that that organization has to say, with, you know, to say about it, no gays will be allowed to be in charge in this organization,
yeah,
would you stay there? And if you say yes, you really have to search your soul and ask why you're saying yes, that you stay there.
866-303-2270 is the number. Where do you stand, Catholic? 17 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Twenty-two past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey,
you're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We're going to have our movie guy on in a few minutes, David Poland. But right now, we're taking calls from Catholics in response to the Vatican maybe dispatching a whatever they call it, a Vatican special order, super secret agenda. It's not so secret. They want to ban celibate homosexuals from the clergy. They want to ban self-admitted homosexuals who are not acting celibate. They are celibate from the clergy. Which is ridiculous. There is no difference between celibacies. And our question to the general public, our listening public, is if you are against the church's stance, then why are you still in the church? And also, what are your reflections on this? We have Joseph on the line from Miami. Joseph, good morning.
Hey, Joseph.
Hello.
What's on your mind, Joseph? You're a Catholic?
Yes.
You might want to turn down your radio. It'll be easier.
There you
go. I'm a gay man, and I'm Catholic.
Okay.
I was raised in the Catholic Church. But one of my perceptions about this is suddenly the Catholic Church, after decades and decades and decades of love the sinner, hate the sin, and how it can be meditated or prayed away, and if you focus enough on a good, clean life, that won't affect you.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, the Catholic Church is basically saying, we now recognize that it's not something that can be prayed away. It's not something that can be fixed. Therefore, it must be innate.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think that's being a bit giving in the sense they are still saying that it is wrong, it is against God, and that you cannot be a part of this church on a clergy level.
Yes, but they're also saying that we can't pray it away. We, the great, powerful Catholic Church, can no longer pray it away or fix you, so we have to accept you as you are.
It's an interesting way of looking at it, because a lot of evangelicals think that they can fix homosexuality.
I don't see where they're saying we accept you as you are. I'm not seeing that anywhere in this announcement. What I'm seeing is that they are saying that homosexuality is so wrong that even if we have somebody who wants to be a priest who is an admitted homosexual but not acting on it and is celibate, he cannot be a priest. I don't see where the acceptance is coming into this.
Well, so it becomes don't ask, don't tell of the Catholic priesthood.
I guess, I think that's the way it's always been, but now he's basically, I don't know how they're going to figure that out. I understand your point, and I think it's an interesting point, but I still don't understand why some people would stay within the church if they are against this depiction of gay men, which is still that it is wrong.
Well, like yourself, Joseph, how do you walk in there week after week knowing that that organization does not want you as an organizational leading member? How do you reconcile that?
I attend Dignity, which is a gay.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, Father Judge was a part of Dignity as well. But see, here's an interesting part of all this. Substitute women for gay and ask the same question.
Right, and that's been happening forever.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your call, Joseph. Let's take a couple other calls while we got a minute here. Brian, listening in New York, streaming. What's up, Brian?
Hey, Brian.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
What's up, buddy?
This hard right turn by the church over the last several years is really tearing me apart. My wife and I are both have been raised Catholic. We have three children in Catholic school now. And the thing that I really always loved and prided myself on as being a member of the Catholic Church is that it was a fundamental part of their doctrine that we would be judged not on our words and what we profess to believe, but on what we did, on our acts. And that's a major difference from a lot of other Christian sects, that we, you know, that we as Catholics acknowledge that lip service doesn't cut it. But when you get this guy Benedict turning everything around, and it wasn't just him, John Paul was also very intolerant toward homosexuals.
Yeah.
They're basically saying, oh, that it does matter, that labels do matter, that we don't accept you as you are, and you can't earn your way into heaven like everyone else, that you're basically being judged on how God made you, not on what you do.
Right, Brian, I'm going to put it to you to start the new Reformation. I want you to take your kids and your wife and start a new branch of the Catholic Church. No?
I don't know if I have the courage for that.
Well, I thank you for sharing your thoughts. I appreciate
it.
This is a very interesting thing because, see, Catholics, you know, what you were saying, Brendan, is that why do they stay? It's because they're afraid to leave, buddy.
It's afraid that the truth doesn't match up with what they've been taught. And, you know, seriously, this is what the heart of a boycott is.
If you're not happy with
the product, you boycott until it's changed. And I'm not I haven't been happy for years.
This is some serious mind going on. All right, so here we go. We're going to talk to David Poland about movies. Thanks for all your calls. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 34 past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Hey, I got a weird warning for you people that might be parasailing or windsurfing or surfing or scuba diving or even skin diving off the coast of Mexico. Watch out for dolphin assassins. I'll explain that in a little while. Morning Sedition is heading to New Jersey. We'll be broadcasting live from Maxwell's in Hoboken, New Jersey next Friday, October 7th. Stay tuned for details. That's a week from this Friday. Looking forward to seeing you people. Air America is hosting a special panel discussion entitled Katrina's Wake, Our Government and the Common Good. It is moderated by Air America's own Rachel Maddow. It's tomorrow night at the SUNY Graduate Center at 34th and 5th from 7 to 9 p.m. Go to Air America. AmericaRadio.com for details, and as always, you can email us at sedition@airamericaradio.com. Right now, my pleasure to introduce our frequent guest. The last time we talked to our next guest, he was at the Toronto Film Festival. Now he's back home in Los Angeles. He's the editor of Movie City News and the blogger behind The Hot Blog. Good morning, David Poland. Okay, David. Yeah, no, not there. I don't know what's happening.
Right.
Are you there?
Technology is a magical thing.
What happened there?
Dolphin assassins got me.
Oh, did, yeah, or what? You were dozing or going to the fridge or something. Be honest. Don't blame it on us.
It's 5:30 in the morning. You know, that's what we do in California.
There you go.
So, dude, I'm just reading this that it is that today is the anniversary. The Motion Picture Association of America abolishes the X rating, replacing it with NC-17. That happened this day in history in 1990.
Fabulous thing. Well, actually, it hasn't been such a fabulous thing, but, you know, the X rating never really existed.
What does that mean?
They started the NC-17.
What do you mean?
Well, the X rating was something that pornographers used themselves to put on movies, but it was never actually an officially owned rating that the MPA had.
So it was actually a marketing idea?
It was basically a marketing idea by porn filmmakers.
Interesting.
And then it became something that was freely adapted by whoever wanted it because the MPA didn't actually own the X.
So the X was essentially that, you know, people, it was pornographers saying, like, this movie's really dirty, and then it was just appropriated by the film industry to mean that kids can't go to this.
Yeah, well, it actually was, and it was barely appropriated at that, so it was never actually copyrighted, there was never actually an ownership of it, so anybody could slap it on their movie. There was no requirement that you actually go to the MPAA to get the X rating, well, like the NC-17.
But did the MPAA slap certain movies with X's?
Yes, ultimately they did. That was part of it. But they, for whatever reasons, they had not copyrighted it the way they had copyrighted the other letters.
Mm.
What was your first X-rated movie, David?
The best X-rated movie?
What was your first X-rated movie?
Oh, my first X-rated movie?
Yeah.
Probably Clockwork Orange.
Really? Was that an X? I didn't realize
that. Yeah,
that
was an X. Midnight Cowboy was an X.
Sweet Back's Badass Song was an X for a minute.
Yes, it was. Well, the first thing I did when I came to New York to go to school at NYU was go to Times Square and see The Devil and Miss Jones and Deep Throat double feature on 7th Avenue.
Oh, that must have been dirty.
Ah.
I was but a child, but they were actually already showing porno movies on videotape.
Oh, really?
And I was kind of shocked because I hadn't really gone to porno theaters.
Porno theaters, back then, that was a creepy scene. We don't need to...
I wouldn't know anything about it.
I'm sure you wouldn't, Mark. So, David, let's talk a little bit. I know last time I talked to you, you were at the Toronto Film Festival. What came out of that festival? What have we got going on this week in terms of releases? What are your picks?
Well, almost everything that came out this week was at Toronto, it seemed like, or was opening at Toronto. There's a lot of dead bodies this week, actually. I mean, you look at the Flight Plan, it's a missing little girl, maybe dead, maybe alive.
Is that all that Jodie Foster does now? Is this sort of like intense, kind of panicky, yet incredibly focused mother thing?
Apparently. I mean, the thing is, she's very, very good at being earnest.
Uh-huh.
But she only makes one movie every 3 years, so she has to wait. And based on this and the last movie, she basically has to wait to find a really mediocre movie where she runs around looking for somebody.
Well, they got to find one. They have to figure out somewhere else she can be trapped.
Apparently, they have to birth somebody who looks like her. That's the part of the whole thing. There's a breeding system going on.
So I'm assuming this is not a good film.
You know, it's a weird film because a lot of the things you expect from this kind of movie happen by the end of the second act, and then she takes a nap. Literally, in the movie, she goes to sleep. I think goes with her.
So this is the movie Flight Plan. So what do we got? What else? What did you like?
You know, Roll Bounce is kind of cute, but it's really not very good. But it's cute. It's kind of like you can't quite decide whether you want to hate it or love it.
Roll Bounce is called?
Roll Bounce. It's
Bow Wow's in there, right?
Bow Wow's in it, and Chi McBride, and it's a bunch of people in the 70s, kids in the 70s who roller skate competitively.
Mm-hmm.
And so, of course, there's the big evil guy who's the roller skater from across town, and a bunch of white guys who are particularly stupid and evil.
Does it make you cry like you were a kid?
It put me asleep like a baby. So we went to the premiere. I took my niece to the premiere. She wanted to see the movie last week, which they called for 7 o'clock, and it started around 8:30. So,
Well, what'd she think of it? How old is she?
She enjoyed it. She's 14.
Okay, well, there you go. So
there's a lot of candy at the premiere, so she was really happy.
So it's a good movie for the kids. Roll Bounce. Why don't you take Vivica to see it?
She already saw it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
10% of the quote-unquote proceeds from this first weekend to the Hurricane Relief Fund.
Oh, yeah. That's good.
So theoretically, they owe about $400,000 to Hurricane Relief. We'll see what the check actually looks like.
You cynic.
The last time you got me all excited about the Cronenberg film, you think that this is the catharsis. This is everything that he's worked towards coming together in this film, History of Violence.
I think it's absolutely brilliant. And the funny thing is there are a number of critics in New York who decided to smack it around on Friday, but I think it's a terrific, terrific movie.
You know, have you ever been to, I mean, like, I go to some of these screenings sometimes, David, that they send us on to see films, and I sit with critics. Mm-hmm. And now, I'm not going to lump you in with them because I talk to you on a day-to-day basis, but have you seen these guys?
I mean,
it's like, what do those guys do? I mean, you know, they...
Nothing but go to screenings.
Yeah, well, you know, there's not a whole lot else in the world when it comes to... I mean, it's a weird thing. It's a weird little culture of its own. And some of the guys are more adventurous than others. But, you know, the funny thing is the ones who are more social and the ones who are more kind of with it and better dressed and all of that tend not to be really that interested in film criticism.
Right. Well, they're just interested in plugging movies and being personalities.
Yeah, they're kind of the Richard Ropers of the criticism world.
Sure, the follow the Gene Shalit mustache group.
Yes, well, I think Richard Roper's trying to draw a mustache right now.
Yeah. What about the... It's happening. What about Oliver Twist, the new Oliver Twist?
Very boring.
Really?
Unfortunately. It's a beautiful, beautiful movie. It's the most beautiful photography you've ever been bored by.
Yeah.
In your entire life. You'll go, you'll sleep, you'll start singing to yourself during the movie. You'll actually hear people break out in the theater saying, "Consider yourself a man," and you're like, "I wish somebody would sing."
No one sang. See, that's... I can't imagine Oliver Twist without the singing, without, what's his name, Ron Moody?
You actually have Sir Ben Kingsley, and of course... And he likes to be called Sir Ben, of course.
Yeah. Did he overact as Fagin?
Enormous amount of makeup on his face, and really nothing to do except for chew on the scenery. And he's like chewing the inside of his makeup. It's so bad.
Oh my God. That's disappointing. That's disappointing.
It's unfortunate because you kind of expect something from Roman Polanski. It's like, here's the kinkiest, weirdest guy in the world.
Yeah.
And he's going to make Oliver Twist. There's a bunch of little boys running around stealing things out of people's pockets.
Yeah.
And they don't find anything. They don't do anything. It is incredibly boring.
So it sounds like you did a lot of sweeping at the film in the last week or two.
Isn't that kind of, this is that weird moment right before the real movies start. So
you're resting up, David? You're resting up? Is that what you're saying?
I'm in hibernation.
In movie theaters.
The festival in the real world becomes hibernation.
What about the new Tim Burton film? A lot of people like that that kind of stuff.
I didn't get to see it in Toronto. It was described to me as 8 really good 10-minute films, any 7 of which you could skip. I haven't seen the picture, so I'm sure it's a lot of fun for somebody.
So as a comedian, I want you to give me some fuel for my jealousy. That's not true. I don't need that. But there was a lot of comedian-based movies, or at least a couple. I guess Sarah Silverman's film, is it got picked up, right?
Yes. Well, it was actually went to Toronto with distribution.
Oh, okay.
The company was there and actually had, oddly enough, dinner with the people who were distributing it on Saturday night.
Do you like the film, Sarah Silverman, Jesus is Magic?
I saw it live. I saw Jesus is Magic live. And
the show. It's a one-person show, right?
It's a one-person show. It's very funny. She's very funny. She's, she's very Sarah Silverman.
Yeah.
And, it's rich, raunchy, and it's, I think that The Aristocrats is actually going to help that movie kind of get in.
No good. But what the hell is Tommy Chong doing, a.k.a. Tommy Chong?
Well, he's smoking, isn't he?
He's being Tommy Chong. Dave's not here, man. Go ahead.
He's out of jail, and he's smoking.
Okay.
it's a documentary about the life and times of, and particularly this guy getting thrown in jail for selling bongs on the Internet, which seems like something the Bush administration should really be focused on.
Yeah.
Very proud of our country that we're now putting away, aging movie stars.
Aging movie stars. The aging, non-successful part of a comedy team from the 70s.
Yeah, why aren't they arresting Paris Hilton? That's what I want to know.
Good question. David, tell me a little bit about this movie, Pick Up the Mic.
Pick Up the Mic is the first gay hip-hop movie ever.
Will it be the last?
Well, there's only so much room for so many gay hip-hop movies that can fit into the schedule. But people have actually really liked the picture a lot. It's, it's a moment in history where there's, a small movement. And usually a lot of documentaries are really interesting when it covers something that's really tiny. Actually had a fascinating experience this weekend. I saw on Logo, which is a gay cable network.
I watched the Eyes of Tammy Faye last night on Logo. Yeah.
Well, I saw a couple nights ago a thing about women in the 50s and 60s who came out as lesbians in Canada. And in the meantime, I was having this whole conversation about Brokeback Mountain and whether it's legitimate that these guys spent 20 years not being together because they were in the West and they would be killed and blah, 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 blah. And here you have a bunch of lesbians in Canada who feel perfectly fine going out and becoming lesbians, breaking every code in the book.
Right.
And it was fascinating. And these women were, scared of the cops killing them, raping them.
So you're saying it brings a little glow of integrity to Brokeback Mountain.
I personally, I have some issues with Brokeback Mountain myself. A lot of people like it, but my sense of it is that it was a great little short story because there was really no context about history in the short story. It's really about two men who are on the mountain.
So this is, I just want people in our audience to know, this is the gay cowboy flick.
Well, and in a weird way, it's not a cowboy flick, and it's not really, it is gay, but it's really a love story. But for me, it's 2 hours, an hour and a half of the 2 hours is spent complaining about not being able to be together, when in fact, if they were that committed to being together, I would think they would find, a way to at least explore in a real way that possibility.
Right. I just want to clear up for the audience, it's gay in content. You weren't calling the movie gay.
Yes, I was not doing the Andy Milonakis thing.
Right, so
Andy Milonakis may get off on reviewing this movie over and over again.
So there's gay hip-hop movies, a documentary. Is that a documentary? Is that
true? It's a very gay fall.
Okay.
Maybe the gayest fall in the history of the movie.
Uh-oh.
Capote, which is not terribly gay, but is obviously about a gay man, and there is actually some content in there, but mostly a fairly straight gay portrayal. You have Brokeback Mountain, which is very gay. You have, it's two men who are falling in love, and that's the whole crux of the story. You have Breakfast on Pluto, which is a great Neil Jordan movie about a guy in the 60s who dresses in variations on drag in Irish Catholic school and through his wife, and kind of he's kind of like the Forrest Gump of gay Ireland.
Oh, great. So that's good. I'm looking forward immensely to seeing A History of Violence. Thanks for talking to us, David.
Have a good weekend.
Talk to
all
you
right,
next
take
week.
Take care, David.
That was David. That was David Poland from the Hot Blog and from Movie City News. You know, all I can say, folks, is that it's 47 past the hour. Dolphin Assassins. Stay with us, Air America Radio.
This is Wayne Gilman, better known to the hard body mamas of the greater New York metropolitan area as Newsday. When I'm not busting a cap in some jive cat's ass for hogging the printer when I'm on deadline, I'm having a funky good time with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Ooh, Newsday!
Well, look who's awake. Ready for another taste of Wayne?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
All right, it's 52 past the hour. I can see Monday's runway, Riley. We're coming down. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Look, folks, you know it's getting bad for Army recruiters or for military recruiters when they have to recruit dolphins. But apparently this has been going on for a while. And did you ever see the movie Day of the Dolphin, Riley?
No.
George C. Scott. Don't even, Paw loves Paw. They actually taught the dolphins how to talk. I can't remember the thrust of the film, but they did train. I know the military took the dolphins, the smart dolphins, away from George C. Scott and trained them how to wear a harness and put a bomb on the bottom of a boat. But I don't remember quite. But here, we're laughing, but armed dolphins trained by the military to shoot terrorists and pinpoint spies underwater may be missing in the Gulf of Mexico. The dolphins have been trained to attack spies or terrorists attacking vessels through a signal transmitted through a neck harness. In other words, folks, dolphins armed with toxic darts that are trained to shoot divers might be on the loose. I mean, how can a dolphin differentiate between a terrorist or a spy or just a guy wearing a wetsuit? But unless they're told to shoot, but they could be out there. Now, I don't want to blame the dolphins. I blame the military first for exploiting these poor animals, which are smart animals. And second, apparently they got away after the hurricane. There's a lot of things wrong with this. Why should we assume that their ability to differentiate from a distance is any different than a human soldier at a checkpoint? Do you understand what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah, no doubt. I mean, this is a really wacky situation. Unless, of course, you're some poor guy in a wetsuit who's out doing something and happens to run across one of these.
Yeah, hopefully they won't be pulling any parasailers out of the water with a toxic sweep dart in their ass. But we'll see.
But you know what's funny about this, Mark, is the U.S. has this long history of arming our future enemies.
Yeah.
You know, we sold weapons to Saddam, we sold weapons to Osama, now we're fighting those guys. Pretty soon, I think we're going to have to take on the dolphins.
I hope. I mean, I hope the dolphins win. I hope we are taught a lesson that we can't exploit everything. That's it. If you're either against us, you're either with us or with the dolphins.
Right.
And I think I'm with the dolphins on this one.
And I want to welcome our new dolphin overlords.
Yes. Yeah, right. And we're going to have one on the show, hopefully, by the end of the week. But apparently, back in '89, dolphins were outfitted with harnesses and trained to protect Trident subs off the coast of San Diego. So this has been around for a while. I didn't realize it. But the idea of just these could you just see these little, you know, like just whipping through, and they're just armed. They got two darts on either side of their harness. These little dolphins. Paw loves paw.
You know, I also get the sense that some of these dolphins might be in harm's way if they do detect a mine. I mean, what's going to happen? They may detonate it, and then they're gone.
Yeah. There's a dolphin.
We're
noise.
Under attack.
Help no, we're me. Not. No, we're not. It's jumping through a hoop. It's not an. Did you hear this thing in there? No,
yeah.
You did. All right. All right, look, I don't want to keep people out of our little secret here. It's just a little I wanted a button to make a noise and it didn't. All right. Look, Alice Martin, a US attorney in Alabama, said that CSI, or what she's calling the CSI effect, hurt her case against HealthSouth Corp. She had a case. This is a U.S. attorney, had a case against this corporation, a health corporation, against the guy who runs it, this guy, Richard Scrushy. What a great, weird name, Scrushy. And he was acquitted on securities fraud charges by a federal jury because, as one jury said, quote, we needed fingerprints on one of the documents, or we needed him to say fraud on the audio tape. They always want fingerprints. prints on TV, end quote. Now, this is a problem. It's actually becoming a problem in prosecuting white-collar crime, Riley, because they watch the TV and they're like, how come they didn't do a DNA test?
Can jurors really be that dumb?
Yes. There are people that just cannot tell the difference between fiction and reality, and they expect reality to be like television.
Oh, my God.
So this is weird, because in white-collar crimes, usually it's based on the prosecution is based on evidence that's in emails or accounting documents, but these people want fingerprints and blood DNA testing, or else we don't know how to do this. Uh-oh. There's the liberal agenda from the Streisand compound. Write these down, liberal soldiers. Here are your marching orders. One, criticize doctors for successfully operating on Dick Cheney. Hey, Sawbones, don't you know an opportunity when you see one?
Uh-oh.
Two, spread rumor that Bush prepared for Hurricane Rita by drinking 10 margaritas. Three, insist that the next devastating hurricane have a man's name. Women are discriminated against enough already.
Uh-oh.
Four, picket the show Access Hollywood for not providing handicapped access to Hollywood. And today's phrase, just drop it into conversation, even the Saudis are telling us that Iraq has fallen apart. Wake up, sheeple. Iraq is disintegrating into warring states with completely different agendas. Wait a minute. That's America. All right, so that's our show for today. Tomorrow, what do we got, Riley?
Tomorrow, we got a call from one of your favorite people, none other than Lawton Small from Planet Bush.
And Melissa Bank. I love Melissa Bank. She's a great gal.
Yeah, she's the author of The Wonder Spot and The Girl's Guide to Hunting and Fishing. She'll be here with us in studio. Lots of fun today for a Monday, man.
Yes, sir.
We'll see you tomorrow right here on Air America Radio.